I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Congress is back today for a short summer session, just 2 weeks for the House, three for the Senate, and a long agenda. One item on that agenda, passing financial regulation, just got closer to the finish line with Massachusetts Republican Senator Scott Brown announcing he will vote for an amended bill. Still pending bills on immigration reform, energy, extending unemployment benefits, funding the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, ending the military's don't ask, don't tell policy, and then, of course, there's also Elena Kagan's Supreme Court nomination, all with an eye to fall elections, which come just after the August break. Gail Chadwick is Capitol Hill correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. She joins us to set the table for the next several weeks ahead. And Gail, start with Scott Brown. Democrats removed a provision that would have imposed $19 billion in taxes on financial firms just to please him. So with his vote, how much closer are those Democrats to their financial reform package?
One. And that one could well be an unannounced stand-in senator for Robert Byrd from West Virginia. They could swing one or two more Republicans. But it is very, very close at this point. But with Scott's support, it's now doable.
Well, so I see what you're saying. They need one more, and you mentioned
they need one more.
Yeah, and you mentioned Senator Byrd's replacement. We understand that West Virginia is contemplating how they're going to go about that. But how would that affect some of the other bills on the table that need bipartisan support?
Well, it'll certainly help with the war funding bill. It will unlikely help with the other main promise of the Obama administration, which is to do something with energy reform. West Virginia is a mining state. Coal is still king, and anything that looks like it could rein in emissions is viewed with great suspicion there. So I don't think they'll get any help on energy, but they certainly will on financial reform.
Let's tick off some of the other things on the agenda. The Senate has been debating extending unemployment benefits for 6 weeks now, and in that time, an estimated 2 million Americans came to the end of their benefits. So what do you think is going to happen there?
You know, this is the sort of bill that would just go through in a breeze. Everyone has unemployed voters. It's a major concern. This bill also has popular tax breaks. It has a fix for Medicare payments, emergency assistance to states, all very popular. I think it is a sign of how intense these elections are, in midterm elections, that even easy things are now very difficult to do. Republicans are making a stand on the deficit. They say anything that involves adding to a $1.3 trillion deficit is a non-starter, and it's complicating all of these bills.
Yeah, it's debate over spending, and we hear that there is a debate within the White House between political advisors who want to stop the deficit spending ahead of the upcoming elections and economic advisors who say that spending is necessary for economic recovery. So tell us a little more about that.
Well, that split is running straight through the Democratic Party. You show it in an interesting way with what's happening with the $10 billion added for teachers on the House version of the defense spending bill. Now, teachers, that is a bastion of the Democratic base. Teachers are all over the country. They're getting out the vote. They're manning phone banks, critical to Democratic victories. And yet, even there, you have conservative Democrats very concerned that $10 billion just looks like a lot of money to pay for with a credit card, especially funded by the Chinese, especially on a military bill. And they're very wary to go ahead with it on the Senate side.
And on the other hand, the Obama administration needs some of the liberal Democrats who don't want war funding, and this spending on teachers was seen to sort of, you know, dangled to sort of incentivize them to vote.
A sweetener.
Yeah.
Exactly.
But meanwhile, just in the few seconds we have, the governor's conference just wrapped up here this weekend, and people weren't talking about jobs or unemployment. They were talking about the Justice Department suing Arizona over the immigration law. Just in the few seconds we have, how is that impacting all of this?
Oh, the timing of that issue could not be worse. Democrats did not need another deeply divisive issue legislatively. But what this does is also send a message to the base, Hispanic activists, the Hispanic voters that swung the election last time, and they're hoping we'll do it again. It's a message to them saying, look, even though we haven't done anything on this, it's on our minds, it's in our hearts, and we're pushing forward as far as we can.
But meanwhile, some Democratic governors are worried. Gail Chadwick, Capitol Hill correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Thanks, as always.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Well, Wall Street is being blamed for the recession and the housing bubble, but did Wall Street also cause a food bubble? Remember back in 2008 when people around the world were scrambling for rice and grain? There were riots in dozens of countries. Police in the U.S. were guarding some grocery stores. Frederick Kaufman writes in Harper's Magazine that nothing had changed about wheat, but something had changed about the wheat market. Frederick Kaufman is contributing editor at Harper's. He's also a professor at the City University of New York Graduate School of Journalism. His article, The Food Bubble, How Wall Street Starved Millions and Got Away with It, appears in July's edition of the magazine, and he joins us from NPR's New York studios. Frederick, welcome.
Thank you. How are you?
I'm fine. Although reading this, it's just amazing how complicated something that used to be simple got. Walk us through just a little bit of the history of the wheat market, or this idea that farmers have, for over 100 years, had a futures market in commodities. They could sort of promise to make a purchase in the future. Explain how that worked.
Well, two summers ago, in the summer of 2008, really at the height of what became known as the food crisis, there was a conference in Washington, D.C. about the grain crisis and why the price of wheat was so high. And I had gone there trying to understand why food was getting out of control and why there had been food riots in more than 30 countries and why 49 million Americans were not getting enough to eat and why there were more people on food stamps than ever and why one in five kids were going to soup kitchens for their meals. And between all the speeches, a lot of people started whispering to me and telling me off the record that somebody had cornered the wheat market. In other words, somebody had taken control of all the wheat, driving the price higher and higher.
As you write, this is something that robber barons always wanted to do, you know, buy up everything and then hold on to it, corner the market, and then have control of it.
And so I started looking into wheat and trying to understand American wheat, and I found that there's three kinds of wheat that are traded in American markets, and the most widely exported wheat from the American continent is something called Hard Red Spring. It's a variety of wheat that's traded on this obscure syndicate in Minneapolis called the Minneapolis Grain Exchange. And this Hard Red Spring is the wheat that's used to make the world's bread. It's not used for cake. It's not used for brownie mix. It's used for bread. And the price of Hard Red Spring had gone on this outrageous upward spiral. It usually trades between, I don't know, $3 and $6 per 60-pound bushel. And the price, starting in 2005, it doubled, and then it doubled again, and it kept on going. It finally reached a peak on February 25th, 2008, at more than $25 per bushel. And I was like, what happened here?
Well, you found that in the late 1990s, Goldman Sachs had created a new way to invest in wheat. Tell us about that.
Absolutely right. The Goldman Sachs Commodity Index was created in 1991. But in order to really understand what was completely bizarre and strange and subversive about this Goldman Sachs Commodity Index, we just got to take 1 second and understand just the basics of why there is something called wheat futures trading in this country. For about 100 years, the real price of wheat has steadily declined. It's gone down and down and down. And that's partially why this country has had such success in the past 100 years. A lot of people can eat and food is cheap, and there are a lot of reasons for that. But one of the main reasons for that is futures trading in wheat, the way actual farmers use it and millers use it and people who warehouse wheat, people at General Mills, people at Sara Lee, people at Domino's Pizza, allowed people to price wheat and manage their risks successfully for more than 100 years.
And you remind us that a part of this is that farmers had a system where they would promise to sell a certain amount of wheat down the road in order to get the cash for it now so that they would have some fluidity. They could have money coming in even when they weren't actually harvesting the wheat.
Yeah, the problem with these markets is that they're cyclical. You have a wheat harvest, and it comes at a certain point in the year. And, of course, there's a huge supply, and so the price will plummet. And so over the years, people tried to figure out ways to stabilize this price so that farmers don't go broke the moment they bring all their wheat to the market. And the price doesn't, you know, for consumers and for warehouses, for millers, the price of wheat doesn't go all over the place. And so there are all these strategies to try to stabilize the price of wheat. However, bankers do not like stabilized prices. What they like are volatile markets, because volatile markets are the kinds of markets that allow them to make money. So in 1991, Goldman Sachs really came up with this ingenious new way and completely subversive way of entering not only the wheat market, but the market for all sorts of commodities, and treating these commodities not like what they were, in other words, real things which people had real uses for in order to feed people, but just looking at it as pure mathematical formulation of money. And so what they did is they came up with something which they called the Goldman Sachs Commodity Index. And you know what? Everybody's always blaming Goldman for everything these days. But as soon as other banks like JP Morgan Chase, as soon as they saw the success of Goldman, they all went into it too with their own commodity index funds.
How did they subvert the system? What did they do that was different from the farmers who are actually exchanging products?
That's kind of the essential question right there. And before I go further, I should just say that, you know, there are these terms like going long or going short. When you say going long, all that means is a promise to buy wheat. When you say you're going to go short, that simply means it's a promise to sell wheat. Traditionally in wheat markets, there are two kinds of players. One are the farmers and the millers and the warehouses, people who are actually buying and selling wheat. Those are very traditional people. They've been doing that for hundreds of years. Now, they're also the quote-unquote speculators. In other words, the people who are buying and selling wheat all the time to make money as the numbers go up or down. And those have always been welcomed by the farmers and the millers into the market because they add liquidity to the market. The thing about both the speculators and what are called the bona fide hedgers, in other words, the farmers and the millers, is that for every long position, or another, every promise to buy wheat, they eventually have to close out with a short position or promise to sell wheat. So that at the end of the day, the five times of the year when these quote-unquote futures contracts expire, they're clear. They've bought and they've sold and the ledger is clear. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
That's the way it has been done for more than 100 years. Goldman figured out a way that they would just go long. What Goldman would simply do is what's called roll it over. They'd take all those promises to buy and say, okay, we're not going to buy wheat now. We'll buy it next time. And they kept on buying more of these promises to buy. And what happened is more and more money flowed into these commodity index funds. And eventually what you saw was this incredible demand for wheat futures. Goldman Sachs and all those commodity index funds were not interested in actual wheat. What they were setting up were endless and eternal promises to buy virtual wheat at some point in the future. And that day would never come.
And that created the bubble. That's Frederick Kaufman, contributing editor at Harper's Magazine, making the case that Wall Street, led by Goldman Sachs, created a food bubble. Well, Goldman Sachs responded in a letter to the editor, citing sources like the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, or OECD, which concluded that index funds did not cause a bubble in commodity future prices. And further, Goldman Sachs says their investments provided a stable pool of capital to the markets. But if Goldman Sachs didn't sell, how'd they make money? And are regulators looking to change things? We'll be back in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Frederick Kaufman, contributing editor at Harper's Magazine, who says that Wall Street helped cause the food bubble in 2008 that led to food riots around the world. He says Goldman Sachs, followed by other banks, started index funds of wheat futures. They bought promises to buy wheat, but never actually bought the wheat, making it look like there was a wheat shortage. And contrary to traditional speculators, Goldman kept going long, meaning they kept promising to buy future wheat without balancing that off with a promise to sell, to go short. So, Frederick, the question is, if they don't sell, how do they make money? And you say, well, first of all, this wasn't their money. It was their investors. And they then took advantage of rules regarding how little of their investors' money they had to put into these funds. So explain.
Well, this was really the ingenious thing. What they had done by going long only is completely toppled our normal economic sense. The idea of buying and selling, as everybody knows, is that you buy low and you sell high. That's not what Goldman did. And that's not what any of the owners of the commodity index funds would do. They would buy high, and if the price of wheat futures went up, they didn't care. They would buy more. To an inherently risky market, they introduced even more risk, but they kept themselves out of it. Okay, and how did they do that? They did it through this process which they called replication. If I give you $100 to invest in commodity index funds, actually what Goldman, all they had to do was invest 5% of it. They could keep 95% of the money for themselves. So people would give them money, pension funds would give them money, hedge funds would give them money, and they would only have to put 5% of it into the actual commodity markets. And then with the other 95%, they would take that money and they would put it in the safest investment possible, like treasury bills or something like that. In 2003, there were $13 billion, not a huge amount, as Wall Street goes, invested in commodity index funds. By 2008, that money had mushroomed into $317 billion. Now think about it for a second, Robin. $317 billion going into commodity index funds. If all you have to put into those funds is 5%, you're left with about $300 billion. You throw it in T-bills, you leverage it, you have more than $1 trillion that you can give to your day traders to do what they like with. They made tremendous amounts of money, and it didn't matter if the index went up or the index went down, and they completely forgot that what they were messing with was real.
Explain again, why was the price of wheat going up? Why did there appear to be a shortage? Is it because they were never selling?
Well, because they're always buying these futures, the long future, the promise to buy, pretty soon they've created this huge demand for these wheat futures. Well, where there's great demand, the price rises. When people corner a market, what happens is that usually there's a sense that they've put a stricture on the supply side. In other words, we're not going to let a lot of wheat out. It's very rare that it happens because there's just intense, unbelievable demand for it. And in fact, in one of the most horrible moments of irony in agricultural history, the wheat harvest of 2008 is the greatest the world has ever seen. So in the midst of this unbelievable rise in global food prices, more than 80%, there is more wheat than ever. And that is because real wheat had been completely divorced from virtual wheat. And Goldman and the bankers were making unbelievable sums of money on virtual wheat, while actual people could not afford the real wheat. And people went into a complete panic. And that's what happened. You had a bubble. Eventually, the real wheat showed up. When we finally had this huge harvest, people realized there is no reason for this bubble anymore and came to their senses. But of course, the price of food, as you know, certainly has not gone down to its pre-2005 levels. And most of the analysts I talk to are telling me that we are looking forward to even greater price spikes in food. A lot of the letters from hedge fund managers that I read are predicting even 460% price increases over 2008 highs. And what that would translate into would be $20 for a pound of hamburger meat.
Well, the way you describe it, if Wall Street was in fact in another country, somebody could literally take over the Saudi Arabia of wheat, I think you say, the North America's ability to provide food for the world. Somebody, an enemy of the country, could take it over in the same way Goldman Sachs did.
That's a very interesting idea. I mean, and precisely that is why the Senate Committee on Homeland Security entered into investigations. This unbelievable price rise in wheat made interstate commerce impossible. People who really needed bread and whose business was bread could no longer manage their risks. They could no longer price wheat. And so it's not just the starving people in America and around the world at risk, but it's the big business people who are losing their shirts.
What's the thinking about what needs to change, maybe even, you know, in a regulatory way down the road?
I think the solution in this particular case has less to do with government regulation than actually, I think, going back to a much older way of stabilizing grain prices, which is a grain reserve. And America had a grain reserve for the majority of our modern history, and certainly at times it was a farmer-owned grain reserve. And what that allows is for the Department of Agriculture to say, when the prices are getting out of control, is to say, look, you know what? This is a panic. We have a lot of grain, and we're going to release it to the market, and we're going to bring the price down to the bands where it's reasonable. And there is a tremendous resistance, of course, to grain reserves from USDA also at this moment. Not quite sure why, but I think there is this unbelievable dogma of free market in agricultural markets, and therefore any kind of intervention in those free markets was going to be some sort of a subversion. But in fact, what we're seeing is the real subversion is happening by there being absolutely no regulation whatsoever and no grain reserve.
That's Frederick Kaufman. He's contributing editor at Harper's and professor at the City University of New York Graduate School of Journalism. His fascinating article, The Food Bubble, How Wall Street Starved Millions and Got Away With It, appears in the July edition of Harper's. Professor Frederick, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
He's a folk hero to his many Facebook fans who are calling for him to be freed. He's a criminal behind bars after a dramatic high-speed boat chase in the Bahamas this weekend, police shooting out his boat engine. We're talking about the so-called barefoot bandit, 19-year-old Colton Harris Moore. He allegedly crash-landed a stolen plane in the Bahamas a week ago and has been on the run since 2008 when he escaped a juvenile halfway house in Washington State after a crime spree that included stealing cars, boats, and airplanes, often while barefoot. Bob Friel is a freelance writer who wrote a profile of Colton Harris Moore, of all places, Outside Magazine, because, Bob, you're in the Bahamas now, but you're from Orcas Island off the coast of Washington, where Colton allegedly hid out in the woods and went on a crime spree in 2008. What happened then?
Yeah, back in 2008, there were these blips of crimes, and there were some commercial burglaries, but then there were some strange things of people coming home to their houses and not finding anything missing, but noticing that the shower had been used, the washer and dryer had been used, and if they had left food there, there may have been some food missing. Colton then stole an airplane from Orcas Island, which, when that happens, there are so few private airplanes stolen in the United States, usually about four a year. When this happened, we still didn't connect it to Colton Harris Moore, but it was suddenly something strange was going on, and that's what really perked up the interest.
Well, of course, we should say allegedly he stole the plane, but there's plenty of evidence. And you say that after this, he disappeared in the wilds of Washington State, home of Sasquatch, D.B. Cooper, Twin Peaks, and, of course, now Twilight, and became a cult figure. Tell us more.
You know, it's kind of the perfect atmosphere out there. There's these wisps of fog that cover the island during certain seasons. It's a lot of deep, old-growth forest. So, you know, this is where people sight Bigfoot and where they chose to bring the vampires. And, of course, everybody knows about D.B. Cooper, who parachuted out of an airplane with a satchel of money and has never been found. And Colt was just kind of a natural for that. And then you add the fact that his name was Colt, and he becomes this outlaw. Right. And, you know, it just grew in fascination to that.
Well, Colton Harris Moore, Colt, has a huge Facebook following. Another site popped up today called Free Colton. He has a criminal record dating back to the age of 12. His mom says he has a genius IQ, 3 points below Einstein. It's alleged that he learned how to fly on the internet, and he started planes by hotwiring them and using manuals, so obviously bright. But do we know why he turned to crime?
When he was very young, Colt was diagnosed with depression. He was diagnosed with ADHD. He was diagnosed with intermittent explosive disorder. He had a very rough upbringing. There's a lot of serious issues to this. There's a lot of tragedy. I mean, it's a very exciting adventure story of him with the boats and the planes and things like that. But beneath that, there's issues with child protective services. There's issues with early child development. There are issues with the school system. His fifth grade teacher told me that by the time he got to fifth grade, he had already checked out. He could care less about school. But here was a very bright kid. I've interviewed over 100 people already, and everyone I've talked to outside of school or outside of the police, they love the kid.
So, Bob Friel, do you have any sense of what's going to happen now?
You know, it's tough to guess with this story. I was sitting on Orcas Island, came home from a little 4th of July vacation to news that he went to the Bahamas. So I came here, and I was there on the same island when he was caught and went through this incredible, it was such a fitting ending for the way he's run. He ran to the end, and it involved gunfire and police boats and Miami Vice-type speedboats.
Well, and also this 19-year-old allegedly holding a gun to his head when, after this high-speed boat chase, he was cornered, threatening to kill himself.
He did that. He had told people they would, no one would ever take him, you know, kind of that just classic outlaw statement. And at the end, the way the standoff went, I talked to the guys who were on the boat who shot out the engines and could have shot at them. He could have shot himself, but in the end, he chose not to.
Bob Friel, a freelancer with Outside Magazine. He's speaking to us from Nassau in the Bahamas. Bob, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Okay, after a break, this past weekend, former President Clinton bemoaned the fact that countries aren't paying their promised aid to Haiti. What is going on in Haiti 6 months after the earthquake? We'll check in here and now. Welcome back. 6 months after that devastating earthquake hit Haiti, recovery is slow. In the capital, Port-au-Prince, hundreds of trucks are working to remove the rubble, but almost all of the ruins remain. You'll remember more than 200,000 people were killed by the magnitude 7 quake, and the bodies of the dead are still being found in the debris. Meantime, conditions for the living are horrible. More than 1.5 million people are stuck in the squalor of the refugee camps, many with open sewers running right through them. The people who live in these camps are scrambling for anything they can find to help them survive.
One person's trash is another one's treasure. We actually have people that we call the Cocolats. They travel through these gutters looking for things such as like dirty bucket, anything that could be useful or that can be repaired, and they will go through that filth picking it up because it's nothing else to do.
A resident of a camp in Haiti. Well, the BBC's Mark Doyle was one of the first reporters to travel to the epicenter of the quake in the town of Léogâne. He's back there now and prepared this report.
The scene an hour's drive west of Port-au-Prince is apocalyptic. Almost every single building on the road I'm driving on now has been flattened. Reinforced concrete roofs have fallen to the floors below or have jammed into the ground at crazy angles.
6 months later, Léogâne is still a traumatised place. Most of it looks like the earthquake could have hit yesterday. The rubble from the destroyed houses hasn't been cleared. Tens of thousands of people are living in tents or under tarpaulins. The local mayor is Santos Alexis.
I was flipped over and fell on the ground. I was never so scared in my life. I thought I was going to die. I thought the earth was going to be wide open. I remember I saw that on movies.
You still feel traumatized by that experience?
Yes, definitely.
On my first trip to Léogâne, I visited a rest home for elderly people run by nuns. In January, buildings there lay in ruins all over the compound, and the elderly residents were outside, slumped, exhausted in wheelchairs, as far from the falling concrete as possible. Today, a children's ballet class is taking place. Little girls in tutus and ribbons are gliding about, and sometimes falling over, to deliberately soothing music. It's trauma counselling as much as ballet lesson. Most of these children will have seen terrible things. But at least their school in the same compound as the old people's home has been patched up enough for it to reopen. I go in search of the elderly people I met back in January.
Is that you that came in January?
Yes.
Julie Sifra, speaking through a translator, says she vaguely remembers me. She stands up and grabs my hand for support.
When we came before, you couldn't walk. You were, your feet hurt before.
Oui. Oh,
my feet are better now. And when I think of my hometown, I'm very sick. I would like to go, but I'm broke. I can go. I don't remember my age, really. The only thing I remember is that I got married when I was 19, and I got married in 1920.
I think it must mean that you are 109. Is that correct?
Should have been dead already, then.
We will let you rest.
You might heard news of my death before you get home, guys.
Oh, I hope not. I hope not. Because the sisters are looking after you.
Bonjour.
Bonjour.
But most of the people living in Laogan are less fortunate.
What we have is 5,030 people
right.
living here. 0.5% of those people here has a job.
0.5%?
0.5%. But most of the people in here, they're on the international help that's coming right now.
Well, it's pretty grim now, but I imagine, as you say, when it rains, it must just be awful.
Yes, yes. It's really bad here when it rains.
Daniel Beauvoir is a young Haitian working with a French aid agency. He's found himself running a football stadium full of people whose homes were destroyed. Now they subsist in tents and under tarpaulins that cover every square metre of the old pitch.
But moving them, we don't have enough space. The land to put them is not enough. And those people who have 10 acres of land, they're really powerful in here.
Right.
So it's not easy. We cannot do that. So
right.
we're waiting to find something.
This is the crux of the problem, the reason why an estimated 1.5 million Haitians are still living in tents. Land ownership in Haiti is concentrated in the hands of the rich. The poor can't afford to rebuild their crumbled concrete homes. The government can't afford to buy more decent sites for the homeless and won't confront the rich by taking their land because they finance the political parties. So people get by somehow on charity. Some have tiny micro-businesses. This woman runs a rough kitchen in the doorway of her tent. Her neighbour sells tiny bags of cooking charcoal. Little boys with no school to go to play barefoot soccer on the old pitch in a filthy alleyway lined with tents and plastic sheeting. It's no way to grow up. 6 months after the earthquake, the poor of Haiti are still in desperate need of help.
That report from the BBC's Mark Doyle in Haiti.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Welcome back. You say you're looking for some music to liven up a summer night? Boy, do we have a suggestion for you.
Dile a la mañana que se acerca mi sueño, que lo que se espera con paciencia se logra. 9 horas a París viajé sin saberlo, y crucé por Rusia con escala en tu boca yo.
This is from A Son de Guerra, the new CD from Juan Luis Guerra, the international superstar. It's just one of a bouquet of CDs brought to us by our friend Jose Maso, who hosts the weekly show Con Salsa on our mothership, WBUR, here in Boston. And by the way, is celebrating 35 years on the air. He joins us in the studio. Welcome and congratulations.
Thank you so much, Robin.
I really appreciate that.
It
doesn't seem possible looking at you. But
you
start us off with your dear friend, Juan Luis Guerra. Anytime he has a new CD, in my opinion, it's time to celebrate.
Yes, it is.
Tell us about this song and this CD.
Well, the new CD, A Son de Guerra, is one that includes a variety of different rhythms, and this one in particular was a song he wrote as part of his trip to Japan last year, where he toured the country for the first time, wound up in Fukuoka. So he titled the song Bachata in Fukuoka, in honor of his trip to Japan.
Give us another one.
Well, here's another selection from the CD, one that has a little bit of rock in it. It features Juanes, who is an international star from Colombia, person who organized a tour of several Latin American countries with a host of different artists having to do with peace, and one of them took place in Havana. So Juanes joins Juan Luis on guitar doing a song that has a social message. It's titled La Calle, The Street.
Tú me dijiste que la mañana se compraba con un beso. Que la guerra estaba en venta y que la paz tenía su precio. Que la política se viste de oro, plata y lino fino.
And what's the message of that song, by the way?
Well, it's about the streets and how things are turning from bad to worse. And it's a call for action, asking people to do their role as far as making things better for everyone.
Well, it's a theme that apparently is resonating because you've also brought a CD from Ruben Blades. Also, you're a good friend.
Yes.
And he also has a song about the street, Las Calles. Let's listen.
Las calles de nuestros barrios nunca toman prisioneros.
Ruben Blades was in our studios a little while back with his wife and their project together. But tell us a little more about this CD and that song.
Well, the song, similar to Juan Luis's, has to do with what's happening today in many countries in urban settings, and in particular Latin America. So it's titled The Streets, in which he talks about the difference between the younger generation and the older generation as to how they comport themselves, how they act in communities and in neighborhoods. And he's sort of like making reference to the fact that the younger generation maybe doesn't have the same type of respect as the other generations had for the neighborhoods and the neighbors. But having said that, this CD is very special because what Ruben did here is that he recorded at his home in his studio in Los Angeles, and where he plays maracas, bongos, cowbell, the Cuban tres, acoustic guitar, and metal guitar and 12-string guitar, plus did all the voices, chorus, etc. And the only person who's invited is Walter Flores, who plays flute, and there's some percussion by Mark Quiñones, Oscar Cruz, and Ray Cruz. But other than that, it's a one-man show. It's hard to find because he only produced a certain number that was sold in Puerto Rico up until December of last year. Now he's producing another number that will be sold in different parts of Latin America with different covers and liner notes, etc., etc. So it's a very unique project done by Ruben on his own record label.
You've got another CD. Let's listen. Here in this one, we're going to Cuba.
Yes, in this one, we're going to hear Pupi y Los Que Son Son, a Cuban group that toured the United States for the first time, and a matter of fact, performed during my anniversary, June 22nd, the 35th anniversary of the program Con Salsa. And their new CD is titled Tranquilo Que Yo Controlo. And this particular selection that I want you to hear is one that I really enjoy. It's titled Si Me Quieres Conocer, If You Want to Know Me.
Ellos se preguntan todo el tiempo con quién salgo, con quién duermo, que si vienes o te vas. Es la eterna y vil fascinación del que no he encontrado nunca ocupación.
Again, this is new music from Pupi y Los Que Son Son. What does that mean?
Well, Pupi used to belong to a group called Juan Formel y Los Bambang. And so he sort of like took a little bit of that same sound of Bambang, Son Son. They are who they are, the ones that are belonging to the group, Son Son. And Pupi is his nickname. His real name is Cesar Pedroso. He's a featured pianist, well-known arranger in Cuban music. And that rhythm is one that's titled Timba. And he's very, very popular in Cuba and also in dance circles throughout the United States and Europe.
And this new CD from Pupi is Tranquilo Que Yo Controlo.
Yes, relax. I'm in control.
I love that. And the song, If You Want to Know Me, that's what we were just listening to. Let's hear one more from Pupi. What should we hear?
How about this one, Se Parece Aquel, in which he makes a reference to the fact that a lot of groups in Cuba now sound like other groups that have played before or are very popular at the moment. So thus he's asking for groups to reflect a minute and try to be much more original. So he's sort of like making a critical observation with this song, Se Parece Aquel, He Looks Like That One.
Existe gente que me critica, existen otros que no hablan mal, también están los que siempre imitan, hasta mi forma de caminar, y está
the music of Pupi y Los Que Son Son, brought to us by Jose Maso, who's celebrating 35 years of a show here in Boston, Con Salsa. And on top of this Latin American music world, what's the headline out of the music world?
At this moment, we are doing well as far as producing some new talent, but at the same time, we always pay tribute and homage to those who came from the past, so that no matter where you go, you will speak with musicians and they will speak about the big three in the Mambo era, Tito Puente, Tito Rodriguez, Machito. Or they will talk about some of the bands that came from Puerto Rico, such as El Gran Combo. Or they'll mention the Fania All-Stars as being, you know, a seminal group that you have to listen to if you're going to know anything about Afro-Latin music. So there may be younger musicians and there may be the influence of reggaeton and there may be Daddy Yankee having popularity, et cetera, et cetera. But you're always going to have folks paying attention to what really is the hardcore Afro-Latin music known as salsa.
Well, and you have a list, 35 recordings for each of the 35 years you've hosted Con Salsa, of the greats, you know, Ruben Blades, we mentioned Juan Luis Guerra, Ray Barreto, Eddie Palmieri, his CD is Sentido, and a cut from that is your theme song?
Puerto Rico, recorded back in 1973. The moment I heard this, Robin, this was back in the day when it was vinyl. I played it in my apartment in the South End, and I said, if I ever, ever have an opportunity to have a radio show, this will be my theme song. And lo and behold, it has been the theme song for the last 35 years, Puerto Rico.
Jose Maso, again, host of the Con Salsa radio program on WBUR here in Boston. Jose, thank you. 35 years of a house party.
Thank you. It's always been my pleasure, Robin. Thank you.